Look here, Berger. I do wish you would confide in me.
The two famous students of Roman Remains sat together in Kennedy's comfortable room overlooking the Corso. The night was cold, and they had both pulled up their chairs to the unsatisfactory Italian stove, which threw out a zone of stuffiness rather than of warmth. Outside, under the bright winter stars, lay the modern Rome, the long double chain of the electric lamps, the brilliantly lighted cafes, the rushing carriages, and the dense throng upon the footpaths. But inside, in the sumptuous chamber of the rich young English archaeologist, there was only old Rome to be seen.
HPPodcraft.com.
That was the introduction to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The New Catacomb.
Yes, and we read it ourselves here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're here at HPPodcraft.com and Patreon. Thanks so much to our patrons for continuing to tune in.
Yes.
Now, we're going to try something a little different on the show today, but first, any background on this story?
Yeah, there's actually some interesting background. It was seeming pretty thin when I was searching around. Most sources cited the story as being published in 1922. However, I found the real story from the Wellcome Library blog. That's the library of the Wellcome Collection in London, King's Cross area. It's 19th century collector Henry Wellcome's medical antiquities, plus high-tech modern displays and art. In the blog of the library, it talks about a Sir Arthur Conan Doyle story called Berger's Secret.
Oh.
This is what it says. Berger's Secret is a tale of archaeology, Roman remains, inflamed passions, and a dark conclusion. Whilst you probably won't need Holmesian deduction to work out the story's twist, definitely true, the book that it was originally published in may surprise you, a compendium of Victorian knowledge produced by a major soap manufacturer. Berger's Secret was specially written for the Sunlight Yearbook for 1898. Aiming to be a treasury of useful information of value to all members of the household, the yearbook was produced by the Lever brothers. I think Lever soap is still a thing, right? I've used that before. Whose manufacturing business was built around the success of Sunlight soap. The yearbook for 1898 was its fourth year of publication, and the company certainly pulled off a coup by getting Conan Doyle to write a story for them. Otherwise, the rest of the volume consists of an encyclopedic overview of history, geography, science, and many points in between. Berger's Secret is a relatively little-known part of the Conan Doyle canon, evading the attention of many of his biographers. After appearing in the Sunlight Yearbook, it was anthologized in The Green Flag and Other Stories of War and Sport in 1900, when its title was changed to The New Catacomb. So it's the story we're doing today. The story was written during the period of Conan Doyle's career when he was trying to distance himself from his most famous creation. After The Final Problem in 1893, when Holmes and Moriarty plunged from the Reichenbach Falls, Conan Doyle concentrated on more serious historical novels. However, around the time of the publication of the Sunlight book, Conan Doyle also wrote a number of short stories for The Strand magazine. Published in 1898 and 1899, and later anthologized as Round the Fire Stories, these stories have a similar macabre air to Berger's Secret. So there you go. This story was brought to you by Sunlight Soap. Who says you can't be clean where the sun don't shine? I imagine might have been one of their slogans.
So this was a corporate gig.
Yeah, it's like probably we want to advertise Sunlight Soap, and here's a way to do it without having to buy an ad. We'll just produce our own magazine that people will read for all sorts of reasons and slip in all our ads for soap. So yeah, this was a corporate gig. That's a good way to put it. Where did you hear about the story?
This was in the Classic Weird Volume 1.
Okay.
Next week's story is in Classic Weird Volume 2. The story really isn't weird.
Last week's you grabbed from those collections as well, right?
Yeah.
And these things keep turning out not to be that weird, at least how we define it.
Yes. Yeah.
Certainly macabre or supernatural or ghostly or whatever.
Sure.
But yeah, not necessarily weird.
No.
Here's the deal. This story has a little setup and then the rest is just a bunch of dialogue.
Yeah.
So we decided that rather than just summarize it, once we hit the point where the dialogue starts up, we'll just go ahead and do it with a couple of interjections to describe the action.
Right.
Bit of a radio drama today mixed in with the discussion.
Yeah, it's two characters.
Yeah.
And we're two guys.
That's right.
Do the math. So the story starts off in Rome, in the home of a young archaeologist named Kennedy.
He's about 30. His home itself tells you that he's a Roman historian. It says that cracked and time-worn friezes hung upon the walls, gray old busts of senators and soldiers with their fighting heads and their hard, cruel faces peered out from the corners.
Kennedy is there with another young, up-and-coming archaeologist, Julius Berger. Julius is the son of a German father and Italian mother. He's handsome, blonde, and clean-shaven.
A little time is spent talking about his heritage. He has the robust qualities of the North mingling strangely with the softer graces of the South. It says his strong, firm jaw suggested those old Roman busts which peered out from the shadows. Under its bluff German strength, there lay always a suggestion of Italian subtlety. But the smile was so honest, and the eyes so frank, that one understood that this was only an indication of his ancestry, with no actual bearing upon his character. So, I guess that's saying Germans are honest and Italians are sneaky. I think history bears out, right? Luckily, this guy... You know, maybe not. I think that's what it's trying to say, I don't know. Luckily, this guy, Julius Berger, He himself, not sneaky at all. At least that's what we think at the beginning of the story.
Julius is from a poor background, received a grant from the University of Bonn that started his career. Julius worked his way up the ladder and looks to be on the cusp of becoming the archaeological superstar of Germany. Kennedy, on the other hand, is from a wealthy background and is English. He is brilliant and hardworking, but is more of an adventurer and risk taker, as well as a guy who enjoys life on a more sensual level.
Right, even though he's rich, Kennedy is no slacker. He takes time off to party, but when he's on the job, he's on the job.
Yeah.
That's all he's focused on. In contrast, Berger has never been able to take time off to party. It says, the singleness of purpose which had brought him to the same high level as the rich and brilliant Englishmen had caused him in everything outside their work to stand infinitely below him. He had never found a pause in his studies in which to cultivate the social graces. It was only when he spoke of his own subject that his face was filled with life and soul. At other times, he was silent and embarrassed, too conscious of his own limitations and larger subjects, and impatient of that small talk which is the conventional refuge of those who have no thoughts to express. Even though these guys are of equal status, kind of competitors.
Yeah.
There is a casting of Berger as a bit of an underdog in the relationship. And yet, for some years, there had been an acquaintanceship which appeared to be slowly ripening into a friendship between these two very different rivals. Their common interests and pursuits had brought them together, and each had been attracted by the other's knowledge. And then gradually, something had been added to this. So, they're pals as well as respected Roman archaeologists. And it's a genuine thing.
However, there is a bit of a cloud over Kennedy now, as he was involved in some kind of love affair in which he acted heartlessly to some gentle woman. He's kept a tight lip about it, so no one really knows the details of this relationship.
But archaeology is a boys' club, and it doesn't really upset any of their peers that much. It says, though a head might be shaken or a pair of shoulders shrugged over the flight of two and the return of one, the general sentiment was probably one of curiosity and perhaps of envy rather than of reprobation. So flight of two and the return of one, I guess, means that he was with two women and they both got mad at him, but one stuck around.
Now they are looking over some artifacts. Kennedy wants to know where Julius found these particular pieces.
On the rug stood a long shallow fruit basket heaped with a litter of objects, inscribed tiles, broken inscriptions, cracked mosaics, which to the uninitiated might have seemed to come straight from a dustman's bin, but which a specialist would have speedily recognized as unique of their kind.
Look here, Berger. I do wish you would confide in me. I won't interfere with your treasure trove. I should very much like to hear about it. It's evidently a discovery of the first importance. These inscriptions will make a sensation throughout Europe.
For everyone here, there are a million there. There are so many that a dozen savants might spend a lifetime over them and build up a reputation as solid as the castle of St. Angelo.
You've given yourself away, Berger. Your words can only apply to one thing. You have discovered a new catacomb.
I had no doubt that you had already come to that conclusion from an examination of these objects.
Well, they certainly appeared to indicate it, but your last remarks made it certain. There's no place except a catacomb which could contain so vast a store of relics as you describe.
Quite so. There is no mystery about that. I have discovered a new catacomb.
Where?
That is my secret, my dear Kennedy. Suffice it that it is so situated that there's not one chance in a million of anyone else coming upon it. Its date is different from that of any known catacomb, and it has been reserved for the burial of the highest Christians, so that the remains and the relics are quite different from anything which has ever been seen before. If I was not aware of your knowledge and of your energy, my friend, I would not hesitate, under the pledge of secrecy, to tell you everything about it. But as it is, I think that I must certainly prepare my own report of the matter before I expose myself to such formidable competition.
Look here, Berger. I assure you that you can trust me most implicitly in the matter. Nothing would induce me to put pen to paper about anything which I see until I have your express permission. I quite understand your feeling. I think it most natural. But you have really nothing whatsoever to fear from me. On the other hand, if you don't tell me, I shall make a systematic search, and I shall most certainly discover it. In that case, of course, I should make what use I liked of it, since I should be under no obligation to you.
I have noticed, friend Kennedy, that when I want information over any point, you are not always so ready to supply it.
When did you ever ask me anything that I did not tell you? You remember, for example, my giving you the material for your paper about the Temple of the Vestals.
Ah, well, that was not a matter of much importance. If I were to question you upon some intimate thing, would you give me an answer, I wonder? This new catacomb is a very intimate thing to me, and I should certainly expect some sign of confidence in return.
What you are driving at, I cannot imagine. But if you mean that you will answer my question about the catacomb, if I answer any question you put to me, I can assure you that I will certainly do so.
Well, then, tell me about all your relations with Miss Mary Saunderson.
What the devil do you mean? What sort of question is this? You may mean it as a joke, but You've never made a worse one.
No, I don't mean it as a joke. I am really rather interested in the details of the matter. I don't know much about the world and women and social life and that sort of thing. And such an incident has the fascination of the unknown for me. I know you, and I knew her by sight. I had even spoken to her once or twice. I should very much like to hear from your own lips exactly what it was which occurred between you.
I won't tell you a word.
That's all right. It was only my whim to see if you would give up a secret as easily as you expected me to give up my secret of the new catacomb. You wouldn't, and I didn't expect you to. But why should you expect otherwise of me? There's St. John's clock striking 10. It is quite time that I was going home.
Now wait a bit, Berger. This is really a ridiculous caprice of yours to wish to know about an old love affair which has burned out months ago. You know we look upon a man who kisses and tells as the greatest coward and villain possible.
Certainly. When he tells anything about a girl which is previously unknown, he must be so. But in this case, as you must be aware, it was a public matter which was the common talk of Rome, so that you are really not doing Miss Mary Saunderson any injury by discussing her case with me. But still, I respect your scruples, and so good night.
Wait a bit, Berger. I'm very keen upon this catacomb business, and I can't let it drop quite so easily. Would you mind asking me something else in return? Something not quite so eccentric this time?
No, you have refused, and there's an end to it. No doubt you're quite right not to answer, and no doubt I am quite right also, and so again, my dear Kennedy, good night.
Hold on, old fellow. I think you're behaving in a most ridiculous fashion. But still, if this is your condition, I suppose I must submit to it. I hate to say anything about a girl, but as you say, it is all over Rome, and I don't suppose I can tell you anything which you do not already know. What is it you wanted to know?
May I have another cigar? Thank you very much. I never smoke when I work, but I enjoy a chat much more when I'm under the influence of tobacco. Now, as regards this young lady with whom you had this little adventure, what in the world has become of her?
She's at home with her own people.
Oh, really? In England?
Yes.
What part of England? London?
No, Twickenham.
Oh, you must excuse my curiosity, my dear Kennedy, and you must put it down to my ignorance of the world. No doubt it is quite a simple thing to persuade a young lady to go off with you for 3 weeks or so, and then to hand her over to her own family at, what did you call the place?
Twickenham.
Quite so, at Twickenham. But it is something so entirely outside my own experience that I cannot even imagine how you set about it. For example, if you had loved this girl, your love could hardly disappear in 3 weeks. So I presume that you would not have loved her at all. But if you did not love her, why should you make this great scandal, which has damaged you and ruined her?
That's a logical way of looking at it, certainly. Love is a big word, and it represents a good many different shades of feeling. I liked her, and, well, you say you've seen her. You know how charming she could look. But still, I'm willing to admit, looking back, I could never really have loved her.
Then, my dear Kennedy, why did you do it?
The adventure of the thing had a great deal to do with it.
What, you are so fond of adventures?
Where would the variety of life be without them? It was for an adventure that I first began to pay my attentions to her. I chased a good deal of game in my time, but there's no chase like that of a pretty woman. There was the piquant difficulty of it also, for as she was the companion of Lady Emily Rood, it was almost impossible to see her alone. On the top of all the other obstacles which attracted me, I learned from her own lips very early in the proceedings that she was engaged.
Mein Gott! To whom?
She mentioned no names.
I do not think that anyone knows that. So that made the adventure more alluring, did it?
Well, it did certainly give a spice to it. Don't you think so?
I tell you that I am very ignorant about these things.
My dear fellow, you can remember that the apple you stole from your neighbor's tree was always sweeter than that which fell from your own. And then I found that she cared for me.
What, at once?
Oh, no. It took about 3 months of sapping and mining. But at last I won her over. She understood that my judicial separation from my wife made it impossible for me to do the right thing by her. But she came all the same. And we had a delightful time. As long as it lasted.
Mm-hmm. But how about the other man?
I suppose it's survival of the fittest. Mm. If he had been the better man, she would not have deserted him. Let us drop the subject, for I have had enough of it.
Only one other thing. How did you get rid of her in 3 weeks?
Well, we both cooled down a bit, you understand. She had absolutely refused, under any circumstances, to come back and face the people she had known in Rome. Now, of course, Rome is necessary to me. I was already pining to be back at my work. So there was one obvious cause of separation. Then, again, her old father turned up at the hotel in London, and there was a scene, and the whole thing became so unpleasant that really, though I missed it dreadfully at first, I was very glad to slip out of it. Now I rely upon you not to repeat anything of what I have said.
My dear Kennedy, I should not dream of repeating it. But all that you say interests me very much, for it gives me an insight into your way of looking at things, which is entirely different from mine. I've seen so little of life. And now you want to know about my new catacomb. There's no use for my trying to describe it, for you would never find it by that. There's only one thing, and that is for me to take you there.
That would be splendid.
When would you like to come?
The sooner the better. I am all impatient to see it.
Well, it is a beautiful night, though a trifle cold. Suppose we start in an hour. We must be very careful to keep the matter to ourselves. If anyone saw us hunting in couples, they would suspect that there was something going on.
We can't be too cautious. Is it far?
Some miles.
Not too far to walk.
Oh no, we could walk there easily.
We had better do so then. A cabman's suspicions would be aroused if he dropped us both at the same lonely spot in the dead of night.
Quite so. I think it would be best for us to meet at the gate of the Appian Way at midnight. I must go back to my lodgings for the matches and candles and things.
All right, Berger. I think it very kind of you to let me into this secret, and I promise you that I will write nothing of it until you have published your report. Goodbye for the present. You will find me at the gate at 12.
Okay, quick break from the drama. You're such a jerk, Chris, talking about women that way.
It's just my character, man.
I know, but when I hear you doing that, I can't tell where Lackey ends and Kennedy begins.
Midnight comes, with Kennedy waiting almost a half an hour. Finally, Julian arrives and confirms that he has told no one about the adventure of the evening.
Right, he asks Kennedy, have you said anything to anybody? Kennedy says, nope, haven't told anybody about it. But it's cold, so he says, let's hustle to this place. I don't want to be outside all night.
So Julian leads Kennedy through the streets and to a small house, and he draws out a key. Kennedy is like, what? The catacombs can't be in a house. But Julian explains that it is. That's why he's so certain that no one else was going to find it. Julian has rented it out from the owner and is doing research there. But the owner himself doesn't even know that the catacombs are under this house.
Mm-hmm.
So they go inside the house and they remove some floorboards to reveal stone steps leading down into the earth. Kennedy is so excited that he rushes down the steps.
Be careful. It is a perfect rabbit's warren below, and if you were once to lose your way there, the chances would be 100 to 1 against you ever coming out again. Wait until I bring the light.
How do you find your own way if it is so complicated?
I had some very narrow escapes at first, but I have gradually learned to go about. There's a certain system to it, but it is one which a lost man, if he were in the dark, could not possibly find out. Even now, I always spin out a ball of string behind me when I am going far into the catacomb. You can see for yourself that it is difficult, but every one of these passages divides and subdivides 12 times before you go 100 yards. I want you to follow me closely, my friend. Do not loiter to look at anything upon the way, for the path to which I will take you contains all that you can see and more. It will save time for us to go there direct. I have a spare candle and a box of matches in my pocket. By the way, Kennedy, have you any matches?
No, you'd better give me some.
Oh, that is all right. There's no chance of us separating.
How far are we going? Seems to me that we have walked at least 1/4 mile.
More than that, I think. There's really no limit to the tombs. At least, I have never been able to find any. This is a very difficult place, so I think I will use a ball of string.
Okay, so another break in the drama. What are they seeing down there?
It says Julian led the way down one of the corridors, and the Englishman followed closely at his heels. Every now and then the passage bifurcated, but Berger was evidently following some secret marks of his own, for he neither stopped nor hesitated. Elsewhere along the walls, packed like the berths upon an emigrant ship, lay the Christians of old Rome. The yellow light flickered over the shriveled features of the mummies and gleamed upon rounded skulls and long white arm bones crossed over fleshless chests. And everywhere as he passed, Kennedy looked with wistful eyes upon inscriptions, funeral vessels, pictures, vestments, utensils, all lying as pious hands had placed them so many centuries ago. It was apparent to him, even in those hurried passing glances, that this was the earliest and finest of the catacombs, containing such a storehouse of Roman remains as had never before come at one time under the observation of the student. So these are just the corridors with all that stuff in them.
That's right.
Julian is leading him along speedily, and when we hear Kennedy exclaim, "By Jove!" we will have arrived at Julian's destination, which is a large circular hall with a square pedestal, topped with a slab of marble at one end of it.
By Jove! It's a Christian altar! Probably one of the first in existence. Here's a little consecration cross cut upon the corner of it. No doubt this circular space was used as a church.
Precisely. If I had more time, I should like to show you all the bodies which are now buried in these niches upon the walls, for they are the early popes and bishops of the church. Go over to that one and look at it.
This is most interesting. As far as my experience goes, it is unique. Bring the lantern over here, Berger, for I want to see them all.
In a moment. Do you know how many wrong turnings there are between this and the stairs? There are over 2,000. No doubt it was one of the means of protection which the Christians adopted. The odds are 2,000 to 1 against a man getting out, even if he had light. But if you were in the dark, it would, of course, be far more difficult.
So I should think.
And the darkness is something dreadful. I tried it once for an experiment. Let us try it again.
That will do, Berger. Let's have the light again.
You seem uneasy, friend Kennedy.
Go on, man, light the candle.
It's very strange, Kennedy, but I could not in the least tell by the sound in which direction you stand. Could you tell where I am?
No, you seem to be on every side of me.
If it were not for the string which I hold in my hand, I should not have a notion which way to go.
I dare say not. Strike a light, man. You have to end this nonsense.
Well, Kennedy, there are two things which I understand that you are very fond of. The one is adventure, and the other is an obstacle to surmount. The adventure must be the finding of your way out of this catacomb. The obstacle will be the darkness and the 2,000 wrong turns which make the way a little difficult to find. But you need not hurry, you have plenty of time. And when you halt for a rest now and then, I should like you to think of Miss Mary Saunderson, and whether you treated her quite fairly.
You devil! What do you mean?
Goodbye. I really do not think, Kennedy, even by your own showing, that you did the right thing by that girl. There was only one little thing which you appeared not to know, and I can supply it. Miss Saunderson was engaged to a poor, ungainly devil of a student. And his name was Julius Berger. And that is the end of our little radio drama. There was a rustle somewhere, the vague sound of a foot striking a stone, and then there fell silence upon that old Christian church. A stagnant, heavy silence, which closed round Kennedy and shut him in like water round a drowning man. So Julian is gone, but that's not the end of the story. 2 months later, there is this bit from the European press.
One of the most interesting discoveries in recent years is that of the new catacomb in Rome, which lies some distance to the east of the well-known vaults of St. Calixtus. The finding of this important burial place, which is exceedingly rich in most interesting Christian remains, is due to the energy and sagacity of Dr. Julius Berger, the young German specialist who is rapidly taking the first place as an authority upon ancient Rome. Although the first to publish his discovery, it appears that a less fortunate adventurer had anticipated Dr. Berger. Some months ago, Mr. Kennedy, a well-known English student, disappeared suddenly from his rooms in the Corso, and it was conjectured that his association with a recent scandal had driven him to leave Rome. It appears now that he has, in reality, fallen a victim to that fervid love of archaeology which had raised him to a distinguished place among living scholars. His body was discovered in the heart of the new catacomb, and it was evident from the condition of his feet and boots that he had tramped for days through the tortuous corridors which make these subterranean tombs so dangerous to explorers. The deceased gentleman had, with inexplicable rashness, made his way into the labyrinth without, as far as can be discovered, taking with him either candles or matches. So his sad fate was the natural result of his own temerity. What makes matters more painful is that Dr. Julius Berger was an intimate friend of the deceased. His joy at the extraordinary find which he has been so fortunate to make has been greatly marred by the terrible fate of his comrade and fellow worker.
And that's the end of the story.
That's the end of the story.
Brought to you by Sunlight Soap. Tested on animals, perfected on orphans. Sunlight's the best disinfectant. I imagine might have been one of their slogans. Man, this story is a ripoff of The Cask of Amontillado.
Yes.
By totally. Edgar Allan Poe, which I do want to cover at some point, actually. That's a classic story, but
yes.
It was telegraphed so early on that this going into that catacomb was a bad idea for Kennedy.
It's pretty obvious, but I mean, you know, when you're writing a story for soap, you don't put much effort to it, I guess.
Yeah, why not just grab an old Poe story and dust it off? And it also reminded me of that old, I want to say it's a Tales from the Crypt comic book story, but I think it was adapted at some point. Where it's a guy who's really cruel. He runs a school of the blind, school for the blind, and he's really cruel to the students. And at night, he can hear banging and hammering or something in the basement, right? Do you know that one?
No, I don't know this one. Keep going.
He beats him. He's doing awful things, stars these people, everything. And then finally, they somehow get him down into the basement, and there's like razor blades on the walls.
Oh, God.
And it's a maze, and then they drop all the lights, so now he has to try and find his way out of the maze. And maybe there's a wild dog in there as well.
Oh, jeez.
But he has to kind of find his way through the maze, bleeding everywhere while there's this crazy dog in there. Oh. It kind of reminded me of that one as well. I'm probably misdescribing the story a bit, but it's that same kind of revenge tale.
And it's kind of a risky revenge as well, because what if he got out?
Yeah, what if he finds his way out? You're in a lot of trouble. What if he finds some magical artifact down there that lights his way? You know, that's something that you got to
exactly,
consider as well.
Yeah, if you find Sting or something, you know, and then some orcs get in there. And
there's so many factors. Probably a good idea that he changed the title to the New Catacomb, because when it was called Burger's Secret, that further telegraphed it, you know.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, so that wasn't a great title when it was in the soap catalog, or not catalog, but
maybe magazine. The implication was that his secret was that he knew where the catacombs were.
Right. I think that, yeah, you're right.
But then you get an extra secret, which is that he's a murderer.
I mean, it doesn't matter. You know that something like that's going to happen, especially.
Oh, yeah, obviously.
It would be really strange if he brought him down there and he was like, this is it. And he goes, wow, this is amazing. And then they're friends and that's the end of the story. They share credit on the discovery. And
oh, golly.
It's not a weird tale, but it certainly has Lovecraftian elements. The catacombs, the ancient Roman stuff.
Right.
I think that he probably would have liked this story.
Probably.
Even though it's just a basic revenge tale.
Yeah.
I like revenge tales. That always, I mean, we've talked about that before. That always.
Yeah, all the Death Wish films.
Especially all the Death Wish films. You know, I have never really been a student of the Death Wish films. I know the first one actually was a big hit in the 1970s when crime was rampant. It was really appealing to some sort of sense of vigilantism in folks' spirits. And then they got progressively more and more crazy, right? So like the third and the fourth Death Wishes are like amazingly awesome B-movies.
Right.
Sometime I got to go back and watch those.
I'm not a student of the Death Wish films. I only know them really in reputation and a few scenes I've seen on YouTube. You know, some of the more ridiculous things. In the later films.
What a weird way to phrase it. I'm not a student of it. Why did I say
that? I just thought it was great.
I hope there aren't any students of the Death Wish films. It's probably not a good thing to.
Well, actually, Chad, I'm working on my PhD right now, and it's about the Death Wish films.
I'm a Bronson fellow.
I know. A lot of people thought I would do some kind of Lovecraftian thing, but no, it's all about the Death Wish films.
It's all about Death Wish. Apparently, there's an adaptation of this story, not Death Wish, but of The New Catacomb from 1967 that played in the UK. I assume it might be the episode of a show or something like that. I couldn't quite find that information. But it has been adapted before. Couldn't find it on YouTube or anything. It seems like it'd be pretty easy script to knock out, though. I mean, it's kind of all there for you.
And two actors. That's it.
And probably good ones in that adaptation.
We might not be very good actors.
No.
But our patrons are excellent patrons.
They're excellent patrons, and they act in good faith every week, every month. I love them. Why don't we say who a few of them are? I'll start. I want to thank Ludwig.
I would like to thank Matthew Sanborn Smith.
I'd like to thank Mark Victor.
I would like to thank Ernest Hardy.
Elizabeth P., you're all right.
Kim Nielsen, I love you.
Katrina Chan, thank you so much.
Mark Morrison, you've saved us all.
Mortificus, damn, that's a hell of a name.
Gary Dowell, thank you.
And finally, Thomas Munkholt. Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for continuing to support our Patreon. Hope you've been enjoying the shows this month, even though these last couple haven't been weird fiction. And we went for a weirder format this time. But hopefully it keeps you interested.
We're changing it up. We got to keep this fresh. So, I mean, this might totally stink, but oh well. We're giving it a try. And if you like it, let us know on Patreon. Leave some comments. We'll talk about this on our comment show. So there's that feedback going on. We have a lot more feedback and rapport with our audience. And that's fun.
Absolutely. What do we do next week?
Next week is A Story Told by the Sea. This is another W.C. Morrow story. And if you remember, he did The Monster Maker, which was a story we covered. So we're checking out another one of his.
Yeah, when you said another, I was like, well, we did one before? Okay, mm-hmm. The Monster Maker.
Yeah.
I remember that being a great title. I don't remember much about that story. Did he make monsters in that?
Yes.
Perfect. Well, next week, A Story Told by the Sea. That's all we have for this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lack, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com. Also on Patreon.
hppodcraft.com.